Good morning. Today I'm going to read the scripture reading today. It's from Matthew 5, verses 13 through 16, and it is about salt and light. Starting with verse 13, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven, who is in heaven." And I want to say thank you for our veterans, and I hope you're having a peaceful Veterans Armistice Day. I don't know.
Well, good morning, Northern Light. Good morning. It has been a while since I've had the chance to say that. It's good to be here this morning, and I'm honored to be here, to be honest with you. And how's everyone doing? Well, you're looking good. You're looking good. Don't look like you've aged a day. Of course, I don't have my glasses on either, so we'll see. We're told in Scripture that we need to encourage one another and build one another up, and that God is the God of all comfort so that we can comfort others. I'd just like to take this opportunity to personally thank you. As most of you know, I lost my oldest son back in September. He would have been 45 on Halloween Day. But the outpouring of love and support from this congregation made a very difficult situation that much easier to deal with. I think I probably received 35 of 40 cards of condolences, handwritten notes, letters. I probably received about 90 postings on Facebook, calls, plants, flowers, and that love made a very difficult season much easier to deal with. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. Also, congratulations to all of our veterans. Today, and I know there's a lot of confusion over Memorial Day and Veterans Day. What's the difference? Well, let me help you out a little bit. Memorial Day starts with the letter M. It occurs in the month of May, which also starts with M. So you got M and M. It's very easy to remember that. It's the last Monday of the month, and it came out or was born out of the Civil War, the American Civil War. And it eventually evolved into what we know today as Memorial Day. And that day was set aside to remember those that paid the ultimate sacrifice in the defense of this country. Veterans Day occurs in the 11th month, the 11th day, and in about 5 minutes, the 11th hour. And what it is, it started out as Armistice Day, the ceasefire that ended World War I. America was kind of slow getting started in the First World War. We didn't want to get involved. That was a European affair, let them take care of their own mess over there. But eventually, we did get involved. And in fact, in 1917, we started sending 10,000 troops per day for the remainder of the war. There was over 4 million people that served in that war. Out of American casualties, there's 135,000 that died in roughly a year. 35,000 of those died because of the Spanish influenza coming home. They contracted the influenza, and they died. It was a great war, the war to end all wars. The problem was it was followed 20 years later by the most devastating and deadly war in human history. Following World War II, the Korean War, Armistice Day was changed to Veterans Day to remember all of the veterans that have served, both living and dead. So if you're a veteran here this morning, I'd like to ask you to please stand and be recognized. Please. For those of you that can stand. Thank you. Thank you for your service. And I'd like to ask all of us, to pray on a daily basis for those that are serving today, especially those that are deployed over to the Middle East. And I know we have some young people from this congregation. I believe Zach is in boot camp right now. He's about to wrap it up. Chances are he will be deployed in the next year, year and a half, if not sooner. I know there's other young people from this congregation that have volunteered and are currently serving or going through boot camp. But you know, one element of praying for those on active duty right now that people often overlook and forget about is the families that are left behind. Yes, the soldiers, the Marines, the airmen have a difficult job on the ground over in the Middle East, no doubt about it. But the families that are left behind wake up every morning wondering if today is going to be the day. They worry, they're full of anxiety, full of concern, and the real problem is that half the time they can't get a hold of their loved one that's been deployed because they're on maneuvers. So I'd like to ask that you remember the mothers, the fathers, the brothers, the sisters, the husbands and wives, and especially the kids that are left behind. Please keep them in your prayers, and I ask that you pray for peace. All right, well, let me transition over to the message for this morning. What I'm holding here is a 26-ounce box of sodium chloride. It's better known as salt. Now, I picked this up this week over at Cub for about $1.39. And it's a top-shelf brand. It's Morton's. It's the best, supposedly. I could have gotten a generic brand for about 70 cents. Now, most of us probably don't give much thought to salt. I mean, when's the last time you had sat down and had a serious conversation with yourself concerning salt? We take it for granted. It's plentiful and it's cheap. But did you know that up until the Industrial Revolution and even late into the 19th and early 20th century, this was one of the most sought-after and valuable minerals on earth? And in some cases, it was even more valuable than silver or gold. I mean, wars were fought over this substance. Early soldiers, particularly the Roman soldiers, were paid in part in salt rations. There was even revolts from the soldiers that were short or shortened on their salt rations. Our word for salary today is derived from the word salt. Why? What is the big deal with salt? For one, it's a naturally occurring mineral found in vast quantities throughout the world. There are massive amounts of salt mines. The problem was, especially in ancient times, extracting the salt was extremely tedious and dangerous. That's why, in a sense, when it was a form of capital punishment back in ancient times, if you were arrested, tried, and punished by being sent to work in the salt mines, it was essentially a death sentence. Constant exposure to salt dried out the skin, and in a very dry, hot and dry climate, that's not exactly what you want going on with your skin. Additionally, the dust particles would get in your eyes, your nose, your mouth. You would be constantly breathing in these particles into your lungs and on and on. You would literally pickle from the inside out. Another danger came from the mining practices themselves. They didn't have OSHA or mining standards back in those days. They didn't have modern excavation equipment. They simply had manual labor performed by slaves. A salt mine would be discovered, and they'd start digging. And if you know anything about digging tunnels, then you know at some point they need some kind of reinforcement, some kind of bracing, or else the tunnels would collapse. Well, in the Middle East, there's just not that many trees around the service braces. And making bricks was doable, but it was time-consuming and expensive. And it would take an awful lot of bricks to fully support a tunnel adequately. So they simply took their chances. A salt mine would be discovered. Slave labor would be used to dig the shaft and the tunnels. They'd use some form of pick and shovel to fill up buckets underground, which in turn would be hoisted to the surface. The salt would be packed into sacks or other forms of containers. And this would go on until eventually the tunnels would collapse and implode on themselves, burying the workers alive. Instead of attempting any kind of rescue, slave labor was considered expendable, and they had simply moved a short distance away and start digging again. You've heard the term referring to going to work as well. I'm off to the salt mine. That's where it came from. It means it was tedious, hard, and dangerous work. You're probably sitting there thinking, now wait a minute, what about the ocean water or even the salt sea, which we know better as the Dead Sea? Well, I'm getting there. Hang on. In and around Jerusalem and the Palestine area, the primary source of salt came from the Dead Sea. Laborers would take large containers, fill them with water from the sea, pour these into large vats similar to water troughs, typically made out of stone. Sometimes they would pour the water through a cloth to help filter the water. Then they would wait for the water to evaporate, and voila, the residue left behind was salt. It sounds simple enough, except for one major problem. The Dead Sea is the lowest body of water on the face of the planet. The surface of this lake is 1,400 feet below sea level. It's 30 miles long, 9 miles wide, and 1,200 feet deep. Being below sea level, the entire area surrounding the lake drained into this water. It is still considered the saltiest body of water on Earth, and it contains 8 times more salt than the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans combined. There's no vegetation or fish life that can exist in the water, hence the name the Dead Sea. The salt content of the water would kill most contaminants, but not all of them. It wasn't until recent times that they have discovered there are microbes that exist in this salty soup. And those microbes they have found do a terrible job on your stomach and your intestines. So oftentimes the salt being used locally would contain contaminants, some of which cause the salt to lose its flavoring, actually rendering the salt nasty tasting and unfit for consumption. So it would be tossed out. The Romans discovered that this useless salt could be used as a weed and grass killer. So they used it on their pathways and roadways to repel overgrowth. And over time, it would be trampled underfoot and ground into the dirt, and more of it would be added. But what is salt good for? First, it's a flavor enhancement. I mean, no chef worth their salt would make a dish without adding a pinch of salt. Without it, food would taste pretty bland, wouldn't it? I mean, if you took a clump of greens and added no dressing, no vinegar, and no salt of any kind, nothing, it would be pretty bland and yucky tasting. Or what about chips? Or pretzels? Or nuts? Or popcorn? Most vegetables and even fruit is pretty bland without a pinch of salt. I challenge you to walk through any grocery store and look at the labels of any canned or processed food. And I'll guarantee you it contains some trace amount of salt. But eating food with high salt content causes what? Wait a minute. What did you say? That's not what I was looking for, but... Well, the jury is still out on that because the doctor told me I needed to cut out salt too, and then they told me about 6 months later and stuff. Well, they weren't really sure, so keep eating salt. I never quit anyway, so it didn't matter. No, if you eat a lot of salt or any food that contains a high salt content, you get thirsty. That's why bars and restaurants offer free chips, pretzels, and popcorn and so on, because it makes you thirsty. So then you want to quench that thirst, and you're forced to buy their very expensive drinks. But the real claim to fame for salt is what? What is it? Preservation. It's a preservative. In ancient times, they didn't have ice-making machines. In fact, most ancients that were born lived and died without ever seeing, experiencing, knowing what ice was even about. Obviously, they never visited Minnesota, but that's beside the point. And of course, refrigeration didn't come into vogue until well into the 20th century. So it was found that salt acted as a preservative, especially for meat. They'd rub that meat heavily with salt to preserve it, and the salt would help repel bacteria, mold, rot, and decay. Have you ever been to a dentist and had a dental surgery or a tooth extracted? What's one of the first things they tell you to do after you get home? Warm salt water. That's to help fight the bacteria, and it's to help the gum tissue to shrink and to help it heal. Even God likes salt. I mean, he told the priest back in the book of Leviticus, season all of your grain offerings with salt. Do not leave the salt of the covenant of your God out of your grain offerings. Add salt to all of your offerings. Now, with that knowledge in mind, let's take a look at our text this morning, Matthew 5:13. And I want you to note the context of this passage and where it's found. Matthew 5. It's the famous Sermon on the Mount. Jesus had sat down on the side of this hill and began to teach his disciples. And the crowd had gathered around him and they were listening in. And he started with blessings, the Beatitudes. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessings, blessings. In fact, there's 9 blessings that he listed off. Then he took a breath and he came out with this statement. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. And then pausing to take a breath, he moved on from there proclaiming, you are the light of the world. Wait a minute, I'm still back there trying to wrap my arms around this whole thing about I am the salt of the world. What does that mean? What is he talking about? What does that look like? Well, taking what we know about salt and applying it metaphorically to our lives, it comes down to this. Salt is a flavor enhancement, like I mentioned. But in our lives, replace the word flavor with the word hope. If you're salty, do you exude or promote hope in your world? When I say your world, I'm talking about your sphere of influence. All of us have family members and co-workers and neighbors and the sales clerks at the stores that we shop at and stuff. That's your world. That's your individual world. Chances are none of the rest of us will ever meet any of them. What kind of influence do you have on them? I don't think I need to tell you that the world is in desperate need of hope. And then collectively, we, the body of Christ, interact with the world at large, us and our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. Do we promote hope? Not in us, not in this corporate body, but do we promote the hope that is found through Jesus Christ in the world around us? You know, we live in the most populated time in history. There's some 7.5 billion people in the world today, and we have more ways of connecting electronically, virtually instantaneous, around the world. And yet one of the major issues that people deal with is loneliness. The title of this message was, When It Rains, It Pours. And that started out as an ad campaign for Morton Salt. They added some ingredient to it and stuff to keep their salt from clumping up. Because you see that one of the problems with salt, it absorbs the moisture around it. So if it was in a bag, a box, a gunny sack, or whatever, it would absorb all the moisture in the air around it, and it would become hard and clumpy. Well, that's very difficult to pour out of a salt shaker, you know? Now, I know there's no one else here this morning besides me that as a kid, you sat in a restaurant that had these salt and pepper shakers on the table, and you loosened the lid, and the next person that would come along, you know, they'd get a plate full of salt. Now, I know nobody else did that, so. But if it was full of clumps and stuff, you couldn't get the salt out of it. In fact, it would get so hard, you'd have to take a hammer or something and pound on it. But the other use of the term, when it rains, it pours, comes from when encountering a problem, an issue, or a difficulty. Before you get a chance to fix it, something else comes along. You know what I'm talking about? Now you've got two problems to deal with, and then perhaps another and another. In some situations, the domino effect of issues and problems can break a person, break them down to the point of despair and a sense of hopelessness. That's why we're told to encourage one another, bear with one another's burdens. Perhaps that's easy enough to do among fellow believers. But what about others out there? The unbelievers. Those that are desperate and hopeless. Do we reach out to them? Do they see the hope of Christ in you? By how you act? By how you talk? By how you respond to the situations in your own life? As I said, we all know the world is in desperate need of hope. I've listened on KTIS, and maybe you have too. There's a prayer line where you can either call in or send a text message. They won't use your name. But so-and-so wrote in asking for prayers related to their marriage, prayers for their prodigal child, prayers for health, prayers for an abusive relationship, prayers for an addiction, and on and on and on. It's really unbelievable to hear what others are dealing with. Now, when I hear some of these requests, I truly feel blessed. So in your world, in our world, do we provide hope to others? Another characteristic of salt is that its main job is to act as a preservative, to help ward off decay and rot. As a follower of Christ and as a salt in the world, and did you notice how Jesus phrased that? He didn't say when you get up on Monday morning and if you in a good mood, you had a good night's sleep, and you feel like it and stuff, you're the salt of the world then. And when everything's going well in your life and stuff, then you're the salt. No, it was an imperative. He stated, you are the salt. If you're a believer in me, you follow me, you call yourself a Christian, then you are the salt of the world. As a follower of Christ and as a salt in the world, we are to help preserve what is good, what is truthful, to stand against the rot and the decay in our society and our culture. We're also told, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. We're told that we are the light of the world, all of his disciples. Not only are we salt, we're to be the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot hide its light. You see, the cities back in ancient times were built on hilltops and stuff, primarily for defensive purposes. It's much harder to attack a city coming up a hill when they're shooting down at you. So it's built on a hill to act it and serve as for defensive purposes. But lit up at night with torches and lamps and stuff, it was also an aid in navigation. I mean, if you were from Jerusalem, you had traveled to Egypt, and you're headed back in this nightfall, you can see the light for miles away. That was your landmark. That's what you headed toward. Have you ever found yourself in such darkness that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face? Now, if you've ever traveled down through Kentucky, or Tennessee, North Georgia, or even into Arkansas, chances are you've seen painted on the sides of rooftops of barns the slogan, See Rock City. And have any of you ever been there? Yeah, I see a few heads nodding. Yep, you have too. Well, Rock City is outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it's built on top of Lookout Mountain, where it's claimed you can see seven states in the distance. The city, well, more of a village than anything, is built entirely out of local rocks. Every building, every house, the post office, and churches are built out of the local rocks. And it's really kind of cool. I mean, it's a tourist trap, but it's still pretty cool to visit. But its real claim to fame is at the base of the mountain, and it's called Ruby Falls. It's claimed to be the tallest underground waterfall in the world. To access it, you have to travel down in an elevator some 1,100 feet below ground. Now, as a kid, we went there in the summer, And, of course, I was wearing shorts and a T-shirt and sandals because it was hot and humid in Tennessee in July, okay? But 1,100 feet below ground, it was rather chilly. And at the bottom, there was a small path about the width of this pulpit. And it wound along the small river that had multicolored lights on it. And the waterfall was about 100 feet to our left. And our tour guide was leading the way down this path, and there's all these stalagmites and stalactites and on and on. It was really quite pretty. And he wanted to demonstrate just how dark it became when the lights were turned off. And there was about a dozen or so of us on this tour. He asked us to stand where we were, and he turned off the lights. I mean, we were in absolute pitch black darkness. You could still hear the waterfall, but you literally could not see your hand in front of you. We stood there for a few minutes. I mean, there was no light seeping under any doors coming from the elevator. There was no exit lights. There was no light whatsoever. And honestly, it became and felt very oppressive. It felt like just a weight pushing you down. You stood there long enough and stuff, you became disoriented. You weren't sure what was front, back, up, or down. Of course, as a 9-year-old kid and stuff, my imagination ran wild. I imagined this giant anaconda climbing out of this river and swallowing us. And, you know, there were bats in the cave and stuff, and you could hear them fluttering around. But it was disorienting. It was oppressive. And then, in the midst of all of that, he turned on a small flashlight about the size of this one. And instantly, you felt hope. You felt relief. And, of course, then they turned on the rest of the lights, and we walked to the waterfall, which is very gorgeous. It's called Ruby Falls because it's lit up by red lights. If you ever get a chance to go down there and see it, I'd encourage you to do so. I don't have to tell you about the darkness in our world, do we? Do I? You just have to open any newspaper, turn on any news channel, open any social media, and you'll be bombarded with stories of darkness, stories of evil that are so pervasive in our time. You know, the Apostle John wrote about Jesus. Through him all things were made, and without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was in the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." You see, we're kind of like the moon. The moon is nothing more than a cold, lifeless rock. It generates no energy and no light on its own. Its beauty comes from the light reflected from the sun. And so it is with us. We don't bring light into the world. Rather, we reflect the light of Jesus Christ, the Son. And you may be thinking to yourself, "Yeah, I want to be salt. I want to be the light in the world, but how does that happen? What can I do? How do I make that happen?" First, I want to say, no matter how hard you try, no matter how badly you want it, it's not something you can do or manifest on your own. It comes from the power and the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. The only way to have that indwelling is to have a personal, intimate relationship with God. Now, for those of you that are married, or perhaps you're dating, currently dating, courtship, whatever you want to call it, do you remember back in the days when you first met your future spouse? You couldn't get enough time with them, could you? You would go out of your way and do anything possible to be able to spend FaceTime with them. And if it was a long-distance relationship, you didn't care how much it cost. You picked up the phone and you called. I know when Lisa and I first began dating, I had a contract job and I was out of town a lot. I tell you what, I couldn't wait till the end of the day. I'd get on the phone and we would talk for hours. About what? I can't tell you, but we talked. Is that the kind of relationship you have with God? You see, there's a difference between knowing about God and knowing God. And you know what the difference is? It's about 18 inches. This is knowing God, or knowing about God. This is knowing God. It comes from the heart. Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind." I ask you again this morning, are you the salt in your world? Are you a light in this world? Do you have a personal relationship with God? Only you can answer that. You know, oftentimes in this life we're told, just fake it until you make it. And that may be true in some instances. But when it comes to your relationship with God, you may fool the people around you. But God knows you, and He knows what's in your heart. I'm not talking about slipping up or messing up now and then, sin. We all do that. And that's why we're covered by His grace. No, I'm referring to your innermost being, the recesses of your heart, the place no one else knows but you and God. There's a passage at near the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which is rather chilling when you think about it. "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the ones who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons? And in your name perform many miracles?' And I will tell them plainly, 'Get away from me. I never knew you.'" That would be like me standing on Judgment Day saying, "Hey, Lord, don't you know me? Yeah, me. I'm the guy that went to church ever since I was a kid. I was the guy that taught and preached. I'm the guy that helped pack food to feed the hungry. I helped the homeless. I helped the widows. I helped the orphans. It's me, Lord. Don't you know me? I'm David." "Get away from me. I never even knew you." That's the difference. No man is worth his salt who is not ready at all times to risk his well-being, to risk his body, to risk his life in a great cause. Brothers and sisters, we don't have a greater cause. I debated all week about whether to share this with you or not, but I see I've got enough time, and the Spirit moved me to, so I'm going to. As most of you know, I lost my son on September the 6th of this year. What most of you don't know is that he had a lot of health issues. He's been in and out of the hospital over the past 2 or 3 years. And everything that happened to him was complicated by diabetes. So, I mean, he'd get the flu, he'd get a cold, and it would turn into pneumonia. He'd get a cut or a scrape, and it would become infected. And he'd get blood infections, bone infections. He had most of this hand, both hands, amputated. He lost his left leg. In January of this year, January the 5th actually, he had injured his foot back in December, and he was admitted into the hospital. They fought it with everything humanly possible. They just gave him a shotgun blast of antibiotics. And they thought they had it under control. He was in the hospital from January 5th until Memorial Day weekend. They thought they had it under control, and they sent him home. He was home for 5 days, feeling sick, nauseated. It was obvious the infection had spread. They hadn't stopped it. So he was in, literally he was in his doctor's office considering amputating the other leg to try to save his life. He collapsed into the doctor's arms in his office with a heart attack. 44 years old. So beginning on June, the first weekend in June, my ritual was on Saturday mornings I would get up at 5 o'clock and I'd get on the road and I would drive from here to Madison, Wisconsin. Now, if you haven't made that trip, it's a good road. It's I-94 all the way down there. But it's still a five-hour drive. Sometimes I made it in 4.5 hours, 4 hours, 15 minutes, whatever. We won't talk about that. But I'd get there about 10 o'clock in the morning. I'd go straight to his hospital room. And I'd sit with him and visit with him until about 10 or 11 o'clock that night. I'd check into a motel. I'd get up at 6 o'clock on Sunday morning. I'd be back at the hospital by 7:30. And I'd visit with him until about 2:30 in the afternoon, at which time I'd pack up and I'd drive back home and go back to work on Monday. That was my ritual and routine for this entire past summer, every other weekend. He had 4 heart attacks over the summer months. Sometimes they occurred in the middle of the week. They'd call me at work. I'd pack up and I'd head out. And I'd be down there for 3, 4, 5 days at a time. 4 times he had a heart attack. 4 times he resuscitated. He became known as the comeback kid. I mean, it didn't seem like anything could stop him. Not the infection, not the amputations, not the heart attacks, and on and on and on. Well, Labor Day weekend, and by the way, diseases and sickness and stuff, it doesn't take a holiday. It doesn't look at the calendar and see what you got planned or what's going on. Labor Day weekend, my youngest son, who had been my liaison, keeping me posted on what was going on, called and said, "Hey, I think you need to come down." He had another heart attack. And I said, "Well, you know, let me think about it, because honestly, I've been down there 4 times, and each time it turned out to be a false alarm." The Tuesday after Labor Day, I received a call from his doctor. Now, if you know anything about the medical practice, typically it's not the doctor calling you. It's one of his nursing staffs. And he said, "Mr. Dotson, I'm telling you, he's dying. You need to get down here as soon as possible." At that point, I didn't hesitate. I packed up, loaded up in the car, and I took off and told work I'd be back when I got back. That was on a Tuesday. I got there Tuesday night. I spent all day Wednesday with him. And I kept asking the doctor, "Is there any hope? Is there any way he's coming back?" And he said, "No. His organs are shutting down. It's just a matter of hours or days." And I said, "Okay." He had his mother in there with him and my younger son. Thursday morning, the doctor made his rounds around 8 o'clock. And he said, "He won't make it till dinner time. If you got any other family members, anything you want to say, anything you want to wrap up and stuff, you need to get it taken care of." At this point, he was so weak, he was in and out of consciousness. He knew we were there because he'd blink his eyes or he'd try to smile. 3 o'clock that afternoon, the doctor came back in and stuff, and he said, "Yeah, it's just a matter of hours." And I want you to understand something. In my lifetime, I've had a whole lot of practice and dealing with death, dying, and funerals. And it started at a very early age. I lost my brother when I was 6. I lost both sets of grandparents the same summer when I was 10. I lost my biological mother when I was 12. I lost friends from church and school that were killed in a car accident at 15. I lost friends in Vietnam. I've held people in my arms as they took that last breath. I've held their hands next to the hospital bed as they passed away. And you're never prepared for it. I don't care what you do. But when it comes to your child, that's a whole nother level. That's another whole different dimension. So what do you say to somebody knowing they've only got hours to live? It's really not the time for levity. I mean, you could have made some jokes, I guess. "Hey, I hope you have a safe journey. You know, see you on the other side. Hey, hold a place in line for me." I didn't feel like it was appropriate at the time, nor would it be appreciated. So I did the only thing I knew to do. I stood next to his bed, and I took his right hand in mine. And I prayed. I prayed for him. I prayed over him, and I prayed with him. And if you've ever been in that situation, you know exactly what I'm talking about. His mother was holding his head in her arms. His younger brother was holding his left hand, and I was holding his right. There was a nurse, bless her heart. I can't say enough good about the medical staff and the team that he had. They treated him like family, like a member of their own family. There was a nurse that was supposed to have gotten off at 4 o'clock, but she knew he was going out, so she stayed. She stayed with us. At the end of the prayer and stuff, she said, you know, I just don't know whether or not he heard you. I know he did. Because with what strength he had left, he squeezed my right hand and he wouldn't let go. He was just hanging on. On September 6th at 5 p.m., and the reason I know the exact time, there was a clock right across from his opposite side of the room from him. He breathed in, but he never breathed out. He was gone in a flash. I wasn't sure how I'd deal with it or what kind of response I would have, but I want to tell you something. I had an epiphany. A flood of thoughts and emotions raced through my mind in a flash of lightning. And there was two things that I realized out of that I walked away from there. Death is final, and this is real, and this is the only thing that matters. What's contained in these pages is the only thing that's going to matter. Because when you pass through that threshold of death, it's not going to matter what shape your 401k is in. It's not going to matter what size a house you lived in, the number of cars you drove. It's not going to matter about your education, about who you knew. It's not going to matter that your parents were super saints and super Christians, missionaries, ministers. It's not going to matter. What it's going to come down to is you and eternity. And I hate to inform you of this. None of us are getting out of here alive. I hope and pray and trust that we've all got 50 to 100 more years to go. But we're all going to pass through that threshold. What are you expecting to find on the other side? That's our hope. That's the promise. That's what we need to share with the world. I don't know where you're at this morning in your faith journey. But if you don't feel like you've got a personal, intimate relationship with God, today's the day to start working on it. If you've sinned and you feel like you're alienated from God, He's gracious. He's forgiving. And He's caring. He doesn't want anybody to perish. Today's the day to get right with God. If you've never taken on Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior and you want to start that today, there's a baptistry right here. I think it can be ready in about 10 minutes. It's available today. Today is a day of salvation. You're not guaranteed tomorrow. Okay? But brothers and sisters, the words contained in this book are real. And it's the only thing that's going to matter, what you did with it. You have that opportunity now this morning as together we stand and sing.